This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For more information, see jodcast.net.
Our first question this week is from Philip Larouche, and he asks, when normal matter falls into a black hole, a proportion of its mass is converted into energy, which is radiated in the electromagnetic spectrum. However, this would not be possible for a particle of dark matter, as it can neither absorb nor radiate electromagnetic energy. So how would the energy escape?
The background to this question is that black holes, although they're black, the area around them isn't. So the area around black holes is a very active area because things are falling into the black hole. When it does that, it forms what's called an accretion disk. So that's a whole area where matter is swirling and going round and round the black hole in very, very high speeds and eventually decays falling into the black hole. The objects that fall into a black hole, so a thing that starts at infinity, so a very long way from the black hole, and gradually falls in via the accretion disk, typically radiate very large amounts of energy on the way in, up to 10% of their mass converted into energy by E equals mc squared. So that's a very, very huge amount of energy. And in fact, black holes are one of the most efficient ways we know of converting mass into energy or generating and emitting energy. But there's no rule that that needs to be true. There's no rule that anything falling into a black hole has to emit some energy. In fact, it varies how much they emit, and in the case of a dark matter particle, it wouldn't, as you say, be able to emit any energy because it can't emit electromagnetic radiation, so it wouldn't be able to emit any energy, so it would just have to fall in. But there's more to it than that. For this very reason, because it can't emit radiation, dark matter finds it very hard to fall into a black hole. So one of the most important effects that we see in space is angular momentum. If you've seen the movie Gravity, you'll know that angular momentum, that's the rotational momentum that things have, is a really powerful effect in space physics. Ordinary matter, when it wants to either clump together to form bound structures like galaxies and stars, or to collide and to fall into black holes, for that to happen, it needs to lose angular momentum, because typically otherwise things just don't come close enough to each other to really interact and hit each other. The only way that ordinary matter can fall into a black hole, and rather than just whiz past the black hole, is by losing angular momentum. So we don't expect dark matter to really fall into black holes in any serious amount, any serious quantity, because only by losing some angular momentum can any kind of material fall into a black hole, and dark matter can't really lose angular momentum efficiently.
Our second question is from Ike, and Ike says, I was taught that photons do not interact with one another, which is why you can cross laser beams. Now I learned that gamma rays interact with background photons to produce an electron-positron pair. What are the rules for interacting photons?
Ike is absolutely right that in the classical laws of electromagnetism, light is what we call linear. So the laws of electromagnetism are linear. So that means that if you have one solution to those laws, if you find an object that can exist or a phenomenon in electromagnetic systems like light, and you find another solution, if you find two different phenomena that can happen electromagnetically, then if you add them both together, they can both exist in the same place as well. So what that means in practice is that typically rays of light can just pass through each other without interacting, and it means that light can go on without decaying, light doesn't decay as it travels. So that's what linear means in this context. This is only true in a classical sense. This question cuts to the heart of one of the differences between classical and quantum physics. It's only in the classical laws that EM, electromagnetism, which describes light, is completely linear. In fact, in lots of other places, not just quantum mechanics, that linearity does break down. So one is if light is going through a medium. So if light is going through air or through any kind of dispersional medium, then it loses linearity quantity and light, different light rays can interact with each other. But it also loses that phenomenon in quantum mechanics. So when we're down to the level where we're dealing with individual photons, that's when photons can start to interact with each other. This linearity that we see in classical physics, in quantum mechanics, that manifests itself as the rule that photons can't interact with each other directly. So one photon cannot hit another photon and just bounce off directly, because neither of them carries any charge, so they can't interact electromagnetically, and they don't, nor do they carry any of the other charges of any other kind, so the weak or the strong or the colour charge that we get. So that means photons can't interact directly. But what photons can do is fluctuate. A photon can temporarily fluctuate into a pair of new particles. So a photon can pop into existence, a fermion and an antifermion. Those two particles, either of those, can then go on to interact with another photon. So the idea is that two photons coming towards each other, if one of them temporarily, via the strange behaviour of quantum mechanics, fluctuate into two new particles, one of those particles can interact with the other photon. So photons don't interact directly, they have to go via the medium of two temporary particles. Now, you asked about the rules of these things. The same rules that we have for classical physics typically apply here as well. So that's the overall, the energy, charge and momentum of the particles has to be conserved. So even though temporarily, and you know, in a quantum fluctuation, we can have energy appearing or disappearing temporarily, in the end and overall, that energy has to be conserved. And the same is true with charge and momentum. If you're interested in these phenomena in general, the very beautiful visual language for describing interactions like this is called Feynman diagrams, F-E-Y-N-M-A-N, after the great physicist. If you have a look for some of those on the internet, they're very, very beautiful, and they describe these kind of interactions that photons and other particles can take part in.
Thanks, that was a great foray into particle physics there. So our final question comes from Robert Rose, and he asks, is the sun's mass increased by the thermal motion of its atoms following the mass-energy equivalence of special relativity? If so, how much?
The background to this question is, as Robert correctly says, that in relativity, the thing we would normally call mass, so that is the inertia of a particle, does change with its energy, does change with its velocity. So although particles have what we call a rest mass, that what we might call their real mass, their mass at zero speed, their inertia, their resistance to additional motion does change with as their speed approaches the speed of light. So I'll treat this problem as a Fermi problem. Enrico Fermi, pioneering physicist of the 20th century, was famous for being able to estimate quantities in any kind of situation. If you asked, you gave him any kind of problem, he could get it to within an order of magnitude. So we'll try and treat this by using just a few large numbers rather than trying to get the perfect result. So what we'd like to do is compare the typical thermal energy of particles in the sun, turn that and compare that to the mass energy that they have. We have the thermal energy, which is that these particles are all moving around, and we'd like to compare that to their mass energy to see which of those is bigger and what the difference between them is, or the ratio between them is. Because they do have some thermal motion, we do expect there to be some effect on their mass. So Robert is entirely correct that there will be some change to the mass of the sun from the motion of the particles inside it. So the rule for a particle, a given a single particle, is that its energy associated with its thermal properties is that for each degree of freedom a particle has, that's normally 3, it has what we call a half kT of energy. So T is the temperature and K is Boltzmann's constant. So that's telling us that the energy of a particle is proportional to its temperature, or the typical energy of a particle is proportional to its temperature. And the value of Boltzmann's constant is about 10 to the minus 23 joules per Kelvin. So an individual particle has very little energy, as you would expect. Now, the sun's temperature is 10 to the 6 or 10 to the 7 Kelvin. That's for the inner part of the sun where most of the particles are contained. So I'll take that as a kind of average typical temperature of the sun, 10 to the 6 or 10 to the 7 Kelvin. So if we multiply those things together, we get KT, so the typical energy of a particle, and I'm dropping some factors of 3 over 2 and that kind of thing here just for convenience. We get that they have about 10 to the minus 17 or 10 to the minus 16 joules for a single particle at the kinds of temperatures we have in the sun. So let's compare that to the mass energy of these things. The mass of a proton, which is what most of the particles in the sun are, is about 10 to the minus 27 kilograms, and we need to multiply that by C squared to use E equals MC squared to get the energy. So C is 3 times 10 to the 8 meters per second. So what we end up with after all turning the handle and doing all these numbers is that the mass energy of a particle in the sun is about 10 to the minus 10 joules. So we have the thermal energy being 10 to the minus 17 or 10 to the minus 16 joules, and the mass energy being 10 to the minus 10 joules. So approximately only about 1 part in a million or 1 part in a 10 million is the thermal energy compared to the mass energy. So that means we expect the mass of the sun to increase by only about 1 part in a million or 1 part in 10 million for the thermal energy. And that was surprisingly small. I thought that would be a larger number, but it's only 1 part in a million or so, the answer to your question.
Whilst that's a relatively small number, that's still a very big number.
Absolutely. There are a lot of particles in the sun. There are about 10 to the 57 particles in the sun. So that means we would expect that increase is pretty enormous in absolute terms. That's true.
Well, that's great. Thank you very much.
Great. Thanks.